The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
Interestingly, it's probably the only monument in Dublin that's been attacked by the people it commemorates. If you look on the side of it, you can see the effect of machine gun fire in 1916.
The Green Mile, a new walking tour of St Stephen's Green. Also, the Strokestown Famine Archive, and we'll be hearing about a memorial wall that was unveiled there today. Plus...
Up, Dev! Beat them out of town! Up the Republic!
Tensions between the IRA and the Blue Shirts a decade after the Civil War. And rebel doctor, Dorothy Stopford Price, Anglo-Irish ascendancy turned committed nationalist. And later, she helped eradicate TB in this country. And that's where we begin this evening. During the Easter holidays in 1916, Dorothy Stopford Price was a guest at the Phoenix Park home of Sir Matthew Nathan, the British Under-Secretary for Ireland. Other guests included Sir Matthew's two nieces and his sister-in-law, Mrs. Nathan. The diaries of Dorothy Stopford Price offer a unique perspective on the momentous events of Easter week that year, as Lorcan Clancy found out.
On Easter Monday in 1916, Sir Matthew Nathan left his Phoenix Park residence and went to his office in Dublin Castle. What happened next is recorded in the diary of his houseguest, Dorothy Stopford Price.
Monday, 24th of April, 1916. Sir Matthew said he would have to go down and work at the castle. We asked would he be out by four. He said he did not know. We were sitting at lunch, Mrs. Nathan, the children and I, when a phone call came from the Viceregal Lodge. It was Captain Maitland, who said the Sinn Féiners are out. They've surrounded the castle and tried to rush it, but the police managed to close the gates in time.
When Sir Matthew heard the sound of gunshots, he helped to close the gates to secure Dublin Castle. The rebels ultimately failed to seize control of the building.
Sir Matthew is quite safe. He rang up at about 7 o'clock to say he would stay the night at the castle. Tuesday, 25th of April, 1916. Mrs. Nathan rang up Sir Matthew. He said things were better, but three officers had been killed. They have lowered the gas pressure enormously at the works, so we are almost in the dark. We have to supplement with candles. Awful firing went on all the afternoon and evening. Went to sleep to the sound of the guns. A rather jumpy night. Thursday, 27th of April, 1916. So far, the casualties are not very heavy. It is just a matter now of blowing them out of the buildings, so a great deal of firing will be heard. All seems safe in the park.
In her diary entry for Friday, 28th of April, Dorothy mentions the Sherwood Foresters, a regiment in the British Army made up of young volunteers. The unit suffered heavy casualties during the rising.
Friday, 28th of April, 1916. The fighting now is all sniping by the Sinn Féiners from windows. A very difficult warfare for the military. The Sherwood Foresters have lost very heavily, mostly just after they arrived.
The British Army had surrounded the principal rebel positions, using its superior strength to capture or isolate them.
The military have drawn a cordon round the city, and no food can go past that, either out or in. We are outside it, and we are to see what we can do. Heaps more troops are arriving from England. It looks very serious. There is very little in the house. No milk or butter to be got. No meat or eggs. Of course, no shops will supply us. I was surprised we had lasted out so long, but apparently the servants had been getting things in a very roundabout way, via friends of the gardener, etc. Saturday, 29th of April, 1916. 4 p.m. Sir Matthew rang up to say the leaders have surrendered unconditionally. All over.
Lorcan Lorcan Clancy there bringing the 1916 Diary of Dorothy Stopford Price to life with readings by Sheila O'Callaghan. 51551 is our text number. Dorothy's Easter 1916 diary is held in the National Library, and the excerpts we just heard are courtesy of her great niece Sandra Lefroy. Her life spanned World War I, the Spanish flu, pandemic, the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, the Civil War, as well as World War II and beyond. And her personal and professional lives were touched by all these events. I'm joined by Anne McLennan, author of a new biography about Dorothy Stopford Price. Anne, you're very, very welcome indeed. Tell us a little bit about her early life. She was born into the Anglo-Irish ascendancy.
That's right. She was born in 1890, and there were four children in the family, herself, two sisters and a brother. Her father was an accountant, and his father was the Archdeacon of Meath, and in turn his father was the Bishop of Meath. So they came from a kind of Protestant ascendancy background. Her mother was Constance Kennedy, and Constance's father had been Master of the Rotunda Hospital. So there was some medical background as well there. They were very sort of unionist type family, Anglo-Irish, looking towards Britain all the time as sort of their natural lead. Their social and cultural capital was London, not Dublin, even though they were living in Dublin. And when Queen Victoria died in 1901, there's this fabulous story where the little girls are 11, 12 and 13. Dorothy's the youngest at 11, and they all put on their black mourning coats. The blinds are drawn in the house, and the family basically goes into mourning for Queen Victoria.
They had more reason to go into mourning themselves sometime subsequently, because tragedy struck the family when the brother died.
Her father died in 1902, of typhoid. And they moved to London then, and Dorothy and her siblings went to school in St. Paul's, which was kind of a progressive school over there. But later on, she decided that she was going to study medicine, and she came back to Ireland, to Dublin, to Trinity, where her grandfather had gone.
And she was studying medicine in Trinity at a time when female students did not, shall we say, enjoy the same privileges as their male counterparts.
That's true, yeah. I mean, Trinity started to allow women in 1904 as students, and she enrolled in early 1916. So she was one of the first kind of tranche of women in. And while they were allowed to sit the same lectures and to sit the same examinations, their social life was quite different. They had to leave the campus at 6 o'clock in the evening, so they were cut off from all that kind of networking. They didn't eat with the male students. If you were a medic, you had a separate dissecting room. Then there were ladies' rooms and so on. So quite a different life. And the societies then had different attitudes towards the women. So Dorothy was particularly annoyed by the Dublin University Biological Association, which refused women membership, even though she felt they should be allowed in. And in her third year in college, she decided on behalf of the women students to write a petition to the society. And the response was quite overwhelming. 120 members to 2 members voted against women joining. And it wasn't until 8 years after she left college that women were even allowed to attend the association. And in the mid-1930s, she wanted to present a medical case to the association. And she had to ask a male doctor to present the case on her behalf. And he did so. And he said afterwards, at the end of it, he said it was unfortunate that Dorothy's sex debarred her from showing this case herself. But he didn't notice anyone in the crowd going here.
And when was it? 1941 or something around about that time when women were finally admitted to the biological
full membership, yes, and allowed to present cases as well as attend.
She was somebody who had great moral courage. There's one incident cited in the book of her attending a dinner. I think it was in Birmingham, at the Birmingham Liberal Club. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, I love this story. They went with a distant relation, Sir John Simon, herself and her sister Edie, and they were sat down anyway as guests of honour. So Dorothy was between the chairman of the Birmingham Liberal Club and Sir John Simon. And before the meal begins, as would be normal over there, the loyal toast was proposed to the king. And everybody stood up and raised their glasses, and Dorothy remained very firmly rooted to the spot. Sir John seemed to be kind of amused rather than horrified, although his wife wasn't quite so impressed when they went home and told her what had happened. And then the next day, the Birmingham Liberal Club chairman and his wife came to family lunch with the Simons, and Dorothy was there again. The chairman was actually delighted, entranced, he said, with Doherty's courage, and he talked to no one with her. And afterwards then she went and played billiards with Sir John, where she proceeded to beat him. And apparently she strode around the table, a cigarette hanging out of one corner of her mouth and curses streaming out of the other. And she had them all eating out of the palm of her hand.
Now, we heard about 1916. She was in the Undersecretary's Lodge and she was a witness to a decisive moment in Irish history. But at what point did she then herself take up the nationalist cause?
It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when she did, but it was sometime during her Trinity years, and presumably it was the same reason that most other people changed their minds, the aftermath of the Rising and the brutal executions and so on. But we don't have documentary sources to tell us definitely that this was the case. But in her final years in Trinity, she was a member of Cumann na mBan, and she was asked to go down to Kilbritton in County Cork to give lectures on first aid to the lads of the IRA, as she called them, and to the Cumann na mBan women. And she did this, you know, but all of the time she was slightly worried that she wasn't going to be allowed to graduate from Trinity if she was caught.
And what did she do when she went down to Kilbritton?
Well, what she was to do was to give first aid lectures, but obviously a young woman speaking with a British accent would be such a slightly suspect. So the guys weren't completely impressed by her. So one of the lads, John Murphy, whose brain, in Doherty's own words, had all gone to brawn, ripped off his coat, showing off his gigantic biceps, and he challenged Doherty to stop the blood flow in his arm. So basically she put on a tourniquet, used a pencil to turn the tourniquet, and everybody waited in breathless silence until the blood stopped. And Doherty said later, that was the moment when I was seen as worthy to doctor the Cork IRA. Although, like, this was a kind of heroic demonstration of what you could do with battlefield medicine and with nothing, really at the time what she found that what the lads needed, they were in the flying column, the people that she was talking to, they didn't really need dressings or first aid. They needed sulphur powder, they needed instructions on how to bathe, they needed treatment for scabies because they were running around the countryside and they basically weren't getting baths.
Mm. So she had problems with their hygiene. Well, they had problems with their hygiene, she had problems with those problems. After she graduated, she actually went back there. She went back there as what we would call now a GP. I don't know if they were called that at the time.
Yeah, she was a dispensary doctor. When she graduated, she tried to get a job in Dublin, and very few jobs. Far too many doctors and very few jobs, whether you were male or female. So she, when she had been down there, she had realised that the position was vacant. The story went that her predecessor was run out in his slippers with the auxiliaries firing pot shots behind him. So she said anybody was welcome, even a girl. So off she went to become a dispensary doctor. But she found it difficult to convince the British authorities and also to convince the IRA that she was really down there to do a job. And in fact, while she did that job, she did a lot of doctoring of the IRA in her part-time as well.
And how did she get around?
Well, initially she thought she'd get a motorbike because she was quite, I suppose, adventurous. But first of all, she got a push bike. So she went and looked for a permit, which you had to have at the time. And she was told by the Colonel of the British Army that there was no way she was getting a permit for anything. So the IRA supplied her with a pony, a grey cob pony that she called Maria after her niece. And apparently she was a horrific rider and she kept falling off the pony when people would pop out from behind ditches and push her back up again and she'd jog along. But it actually worked very well as a propaganda tool. She says the first day she had a dispensary in Kilbritton, nobody showed up at all. And the next day, there was a huge queue down the road because the talk was of this lady doctor who was going to come along on a horse with saddlebags flapping and so on. So she said it worked in that way.
Now, her life spanned the beginnings of what we would think of as modern medicine. And this was at a time when TB was one of the leading causes of death amongst children. She was in the forefront of the fight against TB right from the get-go, wasn't she?
She was, really. I mean, she came back to Dublin after the War of Independence and started to work in St. Elton's Hospital in Dublin. And initially she was more interested in things like gastroenteritis, which was the biggest killer of infants under 1 year of age. But then she began to realise the effect that tuberculosis was having on children. And the year, say, that the Irish state was founded, there were more than 4,000 deaths from tuberculosis in Ireland that year, and 600 of those were among children. And for children, it was a crippling disease. They generally didn't get lung tuberculosis. The younger they were, they tended to get more things like meningitis, and sometimes they got bone and joint tuberculosis and they were left crippled. So she became very interested in ways of diagnosing and treating this and ways of preventing it. And she looked abroad for her inspiration rather than to the Irish medical profession or even to the British medical profession.
But one of the things that she very, very quickly discovered was that there were a number of children in sanatoriums who shouldn't have been there. They didn't actually have TB.
That's That's right. In 1931, she went to Vienna and she followed Professor Franz Hamburger when he was doing a round in the open air ward in the Kinder Clinic there. And apparently this was quite spectacular. It was an open air ward on top of a hospital. And she followed him around and he was basically doing tuberculin testing on children. And you put this substance in and if they reacted to the substance over a couple of days, they had been exposed to tuberculosis. If they didn't react, they hadn't. I mean, that's a very crude sort of summation of it. There are sort of nuances. But she brought back some of his ointment, Hamburger's ointment, and she started to use it on children. So she asked, could she use it on the children in the pavilion, the children's pavilion in Piemont Sanatorium? I think there were 53 patients at the time, and 14 of them tested negative. Now, this meant that there were 14 children there, possibly...
being exposed to fever.
Yeah, and months. Mm. They could be there for years even. You know, it was a very long-term treatment. And as you say, even worse, they could get TB while they were there, a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
51551 is our text number. Now, she was also an early proponent of the BCG vaccine. It was controversial at the time. This was in the 1930s.
That's right. When she went to Sweden and Norway and Denmark and she saw the vaccine being used very effectively there, particularly by Professor Arvid Wahlgren, a Swedish professor, and she thought that she would like to bring this back to Ireland. Now, at the time, the Irish and the British medical profession, I suppose, had fairly good reasons not to use BCG in that the BCG vaccine was developed by two men, Camille and Guran, and their statistics were somewhat suspect. And in addition to that, there was a huge disaster in Lübeck where 77 infants died in late 1929, early 1930. So there had been a lot of issues around the vaccine, but she was very interested and convinced by what she saw in Sweden. And immediately she came back to Ireland, she applied for a licence to experiment with it. And she got that licence in late 1936. And prior to the outbreak of World War II, she did vaccinate really just a handful of children. But she was the first person to use it here. And as the war progressed, she became more and more, I suppose, convinced of its value and started to propagandise a lot about it. So when World War II ended, she was ready really to use the vaccine. She couldn't get it during the war because it was being flown in by air and it was labile.
And this is, after the war, is essentially where she comes up against John Charles McQuaid. What happened there?
This was in 1942, in fact. She wanted to start a National Anti-Tuberculosis League. And her idea was, get together a group of doctors, then add in vets, then add in, you know, because of bovine TB, then add in sort of, you know, lay people, business people, politicians, everyone. Let's get a huge lobby around this because it's a massive problem in Ireland, probably the biggest public health problem we had at the time, and there seemed to be inertia about tackling it, maybe inertia and despair because this was pre-antibiotics and so on. So she decided she'd have this group of people, and one member of her group was John Duffy, who was a Catholic, and he used to write to John Charles McQuaid and tell him, you know, that this is all proceeding very nicely, there's nothing in it against Catholic thinking and so on. And this wasn't unusual. I mean, we think it's kind of odd now that a doctor would write to the Archbishop and tell him what was going on. Wasn't unusual. And Archbishop McQuaid initially seemed happy enough with the development, but as the association progressed, it seemed to get bigger, more powerful. It was chaired by Robert Rowlett, who was a Trinity professor and a Protestant. Dorothy was obviously a Protestant and Trinity educated, and it began to seem threatening to him. So what he did was they invited him to their first public meeting, and instead of going, he sent along a representative, Monsignor Daniel Maloney. And Daniel Maloney stood up before the meeting could even start and said, it's the Archbishop's considered opinion that any anti-tuberculosis league should be done under the auspices of the Irish Red Cross. Now, instead of everybody saying, well, that's very interesting, now sit down and we'll move on and start our own league, everybody was just seemed to be stunned and taken aback, and no one seemed to think that we can challenge this. There was a little bit of grumbling, a little bit of muttering, but basically everybody agreed, well, if the Archbishop says it has to be the Red Cross, it has to be the Red Cross.
And did she only begin to make headway when Noel Brown became Minister for Health, or was she making headway before that?
She was making a certain amount of headway, but not really at national level. So within St Dalton, she was vaccinating a larger number of children. She was publishing widely at this stage. She was doing a lot of epidemiological work. But what she wanted to do was really to affect the whole national scene, and she wanted to bring in BCG vaccine as a national programme. So she was on a number of committees prior to Noel Brown where they were talking about this, and it was agreed it would be brought in. But there was a lot of debate and discussion as to how this was going to take place. What Noel Brown did was he appointed her as chair of a National Tuberculosis Committee, and then she basically made the decision that we now have a National BCG Committee, and guess who's going to chair it? Herself. And so he basically gave her the leeway to do this, and she cited it in St. Children's Hospital. Now, it was, you know, a sort of a slightly odd decision in that it was going to be funded by the Irish government, but it was going to be rolled out under the auspices of this organisation that wouldn't be directly under the control of the government.
And her work essentially came to an end in 1950. She had a stroke.
She had a stroke in 1950. At this stage, there had the National BCG Committee was established. It had been agreed that we'd have a mass rollout of BCG vaccine. Tuberculin testing had become established in the Irish medical community as well, largely as a result of her work. So she had done and accomplished a lot at this stage. And for the next 4 years, she didn't practice as a doctor, but she did advise and keep very close contact with the National BCG Committee. And I would say that the first maybe 5 to 10 years of its work was completely informed by her vision, even though she wasn't physically the chairperson. She did an awful lot through John Cowell, who was the chairman at that stage.
This started off for you as very much a medical project, but I think as you got into it, you kept on finding things out about her, which were, you know, had nothing to do with medicine. So presumably we're talking about some of the early part of her life.
Yeah, I mean, what fascinated me was initially what I wanted to look at was largely the introduction of tuberculin testing and the rollout of BCG vaccination. And we're always trying to untangle this question of sort of chicken and egg. How did the BCG, how did TB, you know, end in Ireland? So how did the actual epidemic come to an end in the 1950s? Was it BCG? Was it better diagnosis? Was it the antibiotics? Was it improved socioeconomic circumstances? And to do that, I started looking at a lot of statistics, like the Registrar General's reports, the reports of the National BCG Committee and so on. But all of the time, as I was looking at her medical papers in Trinity, I keep finding these delightful little letters and diaries and things. And I keep finding other bits and pieces. And I'm thinking, this is a really interesting woman. So eventually, when I'm finished all of that work, I decided I would go to the Bodleian Library in Oxford and treat myself to a week there looking at Sir Matthew Nathan's papers, because he kept all of her letters to him. And this gave me a fantastic, like, wonderful personal insight into her years as a medical student.
A very, very interesting woman indeed, a very significant woman, but also a woman who partook of or was involved in huge chunks of modern Irish history. There's more than one way, apparently, of fighting TB. Bob texts us to say a West Mayo nurse who served on the battlefront in France in World War One, on returning from the war, found her daughter to have TB. The nearest doctor was miles away, so without help, she removed a lung from her child, an operation performed on the kitchen table. The child lived for many years thereafter. Not to be recommended.
Oops.
Don't try this at home. Definitely not. Anyway, we have photos, documents and more information about this trailblazing woman on our website, including a letter from Noel Brown. So check that out. And you can read Dorothy Stopford Price's 1916 diary online at tcd.ie/Price Diary. Again, details on our website. Anne McKellen, thank you very much indeed for joining us in Anne's book. Dorothy Stopford Price, Rebel Doctor, is published by Irish Academic Press. But after the break, tensions between the IRA and the Blue Shirts in the 1930s, a new historical walking tour of St. Stephen's Green, and the Lynch tribe of Galway and their famous associations.